Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
You could, if you want to, adjust the knobs on the antenna tuner so that the apparent forward power is maximized. But it's going to be a crazy number. You're going to think you're producing 180 watts when you're really producing 100. The alternate approach, the better approach, is to put the directional watt meter on the input end of the matchbox and tune for zero reflected power. And then double check to see that really 100 watts is going forward. So input end, whenever a matchbox has a VisWatt measuring set of needles inside, almost always it is measuring the input end, not the output end. Unless you've got another fancy set of switches that you can put in there where it allows you to find out how bad your antenna is. But that's not the one you use for tuning most of the time. I wonder if that makes some sense, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's what I said. You put the SWR meter or return loss bridge between the transmitter and the matchbox, and then the antenna goes on the output side of the matchbox. This matchbox is just a simple Pi network coil with two capacitors. It's actually for 10 meters because I got an antenna up at a site. And by the way, when you look at it, you get the best return loss or resonance on the operating frequency, but you still get a slightly high SWR. I found out that vertical antennas on the low bands sometimes give you a high SWR if they got a lot of stuff around you. So you can even have resonance, and you still have like a 1.6 or a 1.7. Even though that's not a lot of SWR, you know, it's not a, you know, doesn't sound, you know, bad. You still don't want to have that SWR. You don't want the transmitters running continuous duty to see the stress. So what I was going to use was a, like an MFJ, or have someone do it for me. Obviously, I can't do it. I can't, for obvious reasons. And I haven't done it in a long time, remembered where to put it. And I was right. You put it between the transmitter and the matchbox. But I was going to use an MFJ antenna analyzer, and then just adjust the two capacitors the best return loss for the highest negative dBs, like minus 30, whatever, for the best SWR. That's what I was going to do for the minimum SWR, and then just, you know, put something on the output just to make sure that that's the point where you have maximum power transfer. Because, you know, you're going to first adjust the first capacitor, the input capacitor, start with the input capacitor, find where you get the best, return loss, and then go to the output capacitor and keep adjusting them till they no longer affect each other.
A Pi network, Howie, always has interaction between the input capacitor, which is usually called the tuning capacitor, and the output capacitor, which is usually called the loading capacitor, when the Pi network is on the output stage of a tube transmitter. When it's being used as a matchbox, it acts a little bit different. It's still a Pi network, but when it's used as a Pi network in a tube transmitter, usually the input capacitor is 10 times smaller in microfarads, picofarads, than the output capacitor. The output capacitor is usually a pretty big one. Input capacitor is usually a pretty small one in picofarads when it's a tube. But when it's acting as an antenna tuner, it could be the other way around, depending on your particular antenna's characteristics. But still, a Pi network, the two capacitors, no matter where you're using them, on a tube transmitter or as an antenna tuner, they will always interact with each other. You're going to be adjusting each one of them to get the best dip, so to speak, of reflected power on the input end of the matchbox. And as you rock one and get the best tuning, you're going to have to readjust the other one. You have to go back and forth. They always interact. Because if you redraw, let me drop. If you redraw the Pi network, you think you've got an input capacitor to ground, a series inductor, and an output capacitor to ground. That's what you think you've got. If you redraw it, you realize that the two capacitors are in series with each other. Ground happens to be in the center, but forget that for the second. The two capacitors are in series with each other, and the series combination of the two capacitors is across the coil. Because the two capacitors are in series with each other, you could consider them as a voltage divider network. If the resistive component of input and output impedance to your matching network happen to be 50 ohms in and 50 ohms out is what you want to match, then most likely those two capacitors would be the identical value. If you want the output impedance to be lower than the input, then you want a smaller voltage ratio across the output capacitor than the input capacitor, and you make that one bigger. It's a voltage divider network by way of the capacitors. You could, if you want to, rearrange the circuit and tap the coil and do the same thing. But it's much more convenient to adjust these capacitors, because adjusting the capacitors is the equivalent of having an infinite number of taps on that coil. So it's a lot easier. So they always will interact, and there are a lot of people who see that interaction and they think something is wrong. They're misinterpreting. We've come up to 9 o'clock, a little bit beyond, but it's time for Mel's mailbag. And I hope the battery business is working well for you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, one more comment. Take 30 seconds.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to let you know, this device, this Matchbox, the two capacitors are the same value. The manufacturer says it's bidirectional, all of it. He said it doesn't matter which is your input, which is your output. So in this case, and if you do the sediment equivalent, if you do the sediment equivalent, you'll realize the capacitors are in series. Okay, just wanted to say that in this particular thing, you got a coil and then two capacitors, and the two capacitors are exactly the same value. So, all right, just wanted to make that comment, and just wanted to realize I had, that I remembered physically where to put the SWR or return bridge. All right, thanks, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Yeah, that's always a good question, Howie, because lots of guys now own antenna tuners, and they're really, I think half the guys using antenna tuners don't feel comfortable that they know what it does it, how you should use it, and so on. Half the guys using an antenna tuner are a bit uncomfortable about them. And it's just tuned across the 20-meter band any Saturday afternoon, you're going to find somebody saying that, I don't want to use an antenna tuner because it's wasting all that power. Absolutely not. K2KEY, K2RIW. What kind of burning questions have we had this week, Mel?
Okay, this is K2KEY again. Burning, basically apropos to what we've been discussing. In fact, here's one. It basically comes down to the same factors that we're just talking about. Everything I look at here usually has something to do with new hands and antennas and tuners and whatnot. In fact, here's one. Could someone be injured by touching either side of the coaxial fed dipole antenna when I'm transmitting at 100 watts? Or that's the old question. Is one side more dangerous than the other? Over.
Yeah, in the ideal world, you would be feeding a dipole with 72-ohm twin lead, because the dipole is approximately a 72-ohm impedance when it's really a half wavelength and a reasonable distance above the ground. The next step is that every one of us has put a coaxial cable directly to a dipole. The shielded side goes to one side, and the center conductor goes to the other side. When you do that, Mother Nature considers the two halves of the dipole as a balanced structure. Each one is, let me pick a number, 35 ohms to ground, and Mother Nature tries to rebalance things, and the net result is you end up with some RF energy flowing down the outside of the coax cable, if you just simply do that. If you build a poor man's balun by putting a couple of turns of the coax at the end and taping it together, acting as an RF choke on the outside, and on the inside it has no effect, or if you put ferrite, toroid cores there or whatever, by one means or another you can make a choke on the output, so that now the RF energy is capable of flowing on the outside of the cable, but it gets stopped real soon near the antenna. In that case, the amount of RF energy on both halves of the dipole would be the same. If you didn't do that, I will admit that the side of the dipole connected to the center conductor is a little bit higher in voltage, but that difference is not huge. Let me drop. And with 100 watts going into a 50 ohm or 70 ohm antenna, we can calculate what that voltage is. I forget what the number is. Maybe it's 130 volts. Power is E squared over R. Let me think now. E is going to be power times R square root. Power is 100. Let's assume it's 50 ohms. 50 times 100 is 5,000, if I got it correctly. Yes. Square root of 5,000 is probably around 60 volts or something like that. So there's something like 60 volts RMS on the dipole right side versus left side. And we can calculate that more accurately. At 3.5 megacycles, 7 megacycles, 14 megacycles, if you put your hand on a piece of wire with that amount of RF voltage on it, you will not get a shock. In other words, because of the so-called skin effect, the current that flows across your body only flows on your skin. It doesn't flow any deeper than a few thousandths of an inch to your skin. You will feel heating on your hand. Your hand will sense heating. You hold on to it long enough, and you're probably going to develop a small, if you did it with index finger and thumb, and you squeezed the piece of wire and you held it there for a while, on the two places where those fingers touch the wire, you're going to develop a heating effect that's going to give you a little bit of a high, a white lump of dead flesh in that area because of the RF heating of the skin effect nature. I don't recommend you do this, but it's nowhere near as dangerous as you think. Ordinarily, you put your hands across two wires that have got 60 or 80 volts on them, and you're coming close to the point where you could give yourself an electrical shock, fibrillation. Nasty things can happen. At RF frequencies, that does not happen. You will sense some heating. And if you've got half a brain, the hot hand is going to tell you, let go of that. I bet you've touched some RF circuits in your time, Mel. Tell us about those. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've got my share of burns, shocks, the works, Dick, that's for sure, over the years. I don't wonder how come I'm still around with some of the things I've messed around with, you know, in the years past. Okay, I guess we can say most definitely that there's really no such thing as a ground on the side of the dipole. That's what I tell everybody. It's really not a ground side. Even though, you know, dipole, no doubt, goes to the coax, which is connected to so-called ground something, as the transmitter shield. But basically, as Dick just said, it's only a DC-only ground, basically, we call that. So, if you're going to fool around with RF voltage, I don't think it's important for you to put your hands on the wire directly to see if you can get a burn over.
At the 10-watt level, go ahead and experiment if you want to. It's a relatively safe thing to do. At the 100-watt level, it's starting to get a little bit less safe. And as you move your fingers down the dipole further and further away from the feed point, closer and closer to the tip of the dipole where the voltage gets higher and higher, you're going to see two different effects. Number one, as you move your fingers closer to the tip of the dipole, you're going to be detuning the dipole more rapidly, and therefore the standing wave ratio the transmitter is going to see is going to start increasing real fast, and the transmitter might trip itself out. In other words, go to the low power mode or stop transmitting because you've exceeded the VSWR detecting circuit in the transmitter that's protecting the final stage. But if that didn't happen, the higher and higher voltage is going to give you more and more of this heating effect on your hand. So we've all done that. If you calculate the amount of RF energy going into your body on, say, for instance, a 40-meter dipole, which is 67 feet long, and you're standing near the middle of it because this thing is draping across the roof of your house, you know, it's going from one peak to the other peak of the house, and you're standing in the middle of it, and your body is very close to that dipole, and 100 watts is being radiated by it. You go through that calculation, and there's a good probability you'll find out it is safe by the American standard because it's spreading its energy along a 67-foot length, and you're only covering up 1 foot of that length, so to speak, or 2 feet of it. So you're getting 1/30th of the energy. And that 1/30th of the energy, a lot of it is going through you, not stopping at your body. At normal HF frequencies, most of the energy flows through you without doing anything. So it's a relatively safe thing to do. I don't recommend you do that for long periods of time, but as an experiment that you're running while you're looking at a meter and you walk up to there real rapidly and read the meter and then walk away, you're not going to be damaging your body by that kind of an op.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's an RF transmitting system. You can call it an RF radiating system if you want to, and the person hearing the word radiation gets scared and they think it's nuclear radiation. It's not. This cell phone restriction rules that lots and lots of towns are writing all kinds of zoning laws trying to restrict where they're allowed to put cell phone base stations. And even though they're not allowed to say it, left-handedly, they're all putting those words into the zoning law, which says that the cell tower cannot be any closer than 500 feet to a place of worship, a place of study like a school or a residence, which essentially everything in the town. You can't put it anywhere. And that 500 foot rule is because somebody thinks that the RF radiation at 500 feet is safe. The number is dead wrong. The right number is 5 feet, not 500 feet. And even 5 feet, there would be a safety factor built into it. The real number is around 2 feet. During the rush hour of drive time when a cell site is talking to 15, 20, 30 people at once and is running maximum power, and if you stand 2 feet away from that antenna and stare straight into it because you're on top of a 100-foot hook and ladder and your fire department has allowed you to run this experiment on this 100-foot high cell tower and you're standing in front of the antenna 2 feet away, you're at the threshold of alarm where the total amount of radio frequency RF energy getting into your body is now at the biohazard maximum permitted exposure by the U.S. standard. 5 feet, you'd be safe. 500 feet is preposterous. And that's on the assumption that it's at the same level as the houses. It's 100 feet higher than the houses. It's got a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. It's safe as all heck. The amount of energy getting into your body is 1 million times greater when you hold that cell phone against your ear, as opposed to living directly next door.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I know we're getting a little bit off the subject of what the guy is asking, but just to be on the safe side as far as people becoming uncomfortable, don't put the antenna where people are going to be walking. But even if somebody did walk up to it while you're transmitting and touched it, he would send some heat on his hand, he would let go. He would think the wire is hot. He would think somebody had aimed a blowtorch at the wire 3 minutes ago before he arrived. He touches the wire while you're transmitting, and he would think he's touching a hot wire. That's the sensation he would get. He would have no other sensation. And by normal human reaction, he would let go and say, I don't want to hold on to this hot object. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, the bottom line is, don't do that. That's what I'd say. Don't put anything like that in a hazardous position where anyone can walk into it or anything, because even any slight little burn or whatever it is sounds like a lawsuit pending, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, as far as cell sites go, that's a whole other ballgame. In fact, up at the hospital where I go to up there, they have no cell sites right there on their property. Is about a block away in a park area. That's where the cell site is. There is nothing on the building there at all. That is a specification that they won't permit a cell site right on the property itself on any of the medical buildings over.
There is another reason why that might be almost reasonable, Mel. Many a hospital will tell you not to run your ham radio, handy-talky transmitter, or your cell phone in the hospital, because in the early days, some of the sensitive instrumentation that's doing cardiac monitoring, EKG machines, X-ray machines, and whatever, some of those machines were quite RF-sensitive in the early days. And so the possibility of them getting a erroneous indication while they're monitoring a patient because you've turned on a transmitter 5 feet away, they used to worry about that. Now modern-day transmitters, heart pacers, defibrillators, and all of these things, they're being designed in such a way that you could run a cell phone alongside of them, you could run a handy-talkie 2 feet away, and with rare exception, you're not going to get a problem. So there was reason for that spec in the early days. I don't think it's required anymore, but for a whole bunch of reasons, a number of hospitals are afraid to have a cell site co-located. There are a number of hospitals on Long Island that shall remain nameless, where on the roof of the building there is a cell site. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now prohibit any use of the cell phone, because everybody's using their cell phone there constantly. It's always somebody yakking away on their cell phone. That's for sure. People can't live, you know, 5 minutes without it. So their cell site is close enough to be used, but whatever the reasons, their reasons. So maybe I could say one time yes, but I guess they just carried it over, Dick. All right, let's see. We'll do one more.
Go right ahead, Bill. And you could talk a little bit louder into your microphone.
Okay, roger, roger. I've got a little closer. My transceiver has a built-in antenna tuner, but it can only provide a decent SWR in the middle of the 80-meter band. I am using a G5RV antenna. Do you think if I want to operate some other part of the band, it would pay for me to now invest in a new another tuner, an external tuner? Go ahead.
If his transceiver has a built-in antenna tuner, and most of them nowadays are automatic operating, and if his antenna, let's say, for instance, it works very well at 3.8 megacycles, but it will not arrive at a good tuning at 3.5 or 4.0. I'm a little bit amazed by that. And there's two things that can be going on. Number one, there's something funny with the antenna, where the true standing wave ratio at 3.5 megs, in my example, is so high that it's out of the apparent range of the tuner. That's one thing. In which case, the antenna is too short, it's mounted too close to the ground. There's a number of ways you can find out what's going on. By running the transmitter at a low enough power where it doesn't trip out, even if the antenna tuner doesn't come to a solution, and by using some kind of a directional indicator, a standing wave ratio bridge, an impedance analyzer, a Berg wattmeter, by using some kind of directional sensing equipment connected to the feed line to the antenna, you can measure what is the real standing wave ratio at, say, 3.5 megs. And if it happens to be 8 to 1, and your automatic antenna tuner cannot tolerate more than 5 to 1, that would be an explanation. In which case, if you know it's an 8 to 1, there's ways you can correct that. You can find out it's too short, too long, not high enough, whatever. And even if it is an 8 to 1, and your antenna tuner cannot tolerate more than a 5 to 1, there's at least one more solution, and that is add another random length of transmission line and try again. The high 8 to 1 standing wave ratio in my example, let me drop, is a particular impedance. There's a certain resistive component and a certain reactive component to that impedance that's giving you an 8 to 1. That represents a dot somewhere on the Smith chart. The Smith chart is a graph of all possible impedances of an antenna. And there's a dot somewhere on that Smith chart. Your particular antenna tuner has got a paramecium-shaped curve, a shaded area on that Smith chart where it can handle the signal. It can handle the standing wave ratio. You're going to shade in a certain area. If the manufacturer of your rig gave you enough information, it would give you a piece of Smith chart with a certain portion of it shaded in. And if your dot is inside the shaded in area, you arrive at a solution. If your dot of your real impedance is outside of the shaded area, you don't make it. However, by adding a random length of transmission line, you're not going to correct the standing wave ratio of your dot, you're going to move it. The dot has a certain distance from the center of the chart that represents the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. By adding a length of cable to your transmission line, you're doing the equivalent of taking a compass where the sharp point is in the center of the Smith chart and the pencil is on your dot, and you're now rotating that compass. And if you rotate the compass, which is really putting a random length of transmission line in there, and your dot now goes into the shaded area where your antenna tuner can handle it, you're back in business. So before giving up, try a couple of extra length of cable added to do that. But the real way to quantitatively find out what's going on is to borrow somebody's vis watt meter, bird watt meter, and impedance analyzer and whatever, and find out at each one of your favorite frequencies what is your particular antenna doing. If your antenna tuner, if you measure on...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If your antenna tuner doesn't work at the low end of the band, 3.5 megs, and you make a measurement with good instrumentation, and you find that your antenna has got a 1.3 standing wave ratio at 3.5 megs. In other words, it's a beautiful antenna, and your antenna tuner automatically is not finding it, then it's time to find out what's going on with the antenna tuner. So by making measurements, you find out, is it fish or fowl? Where's the grief? How bad is the grief? And what can I do to correct it? And there's lots of ways of correcting it. But to know which way to go, you're going to have to make a couple of measurements. Borrow somebody's test equipment and measure your antenna. K2KEY, those are some of my suggestions, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Question, KC12TY.
LTY, start up your name and then your question.
My name is Richie, KC12TY is the call. How important is the length of your transmission line, your coax cable, from the radio to the antenna? If it's 75 feet or 125 feet?
The length doesn't matter in many ways of looking at it, Richie. In the early days, before, if you go back far enough in time, before Mel and Dick were born, you got to really go back to do that, back to the 30s, the average ham shack in the 1930s was in a wooden building in the attic, in a wooden building on the third floor in the attic. On a wooden table was the transmitter. That was the center of the dipole. One wire went out the north window, one wire went out the south window, and the transmitter sat in the center. The transmission line had zero length. Worked like a charm. Many a guy has got the transmission line because his favorite place to put the antenna is 300 feet away. He's got 300 feet of transmission line. As long as it's low enough at loss, at his particular frequency, it works like a charm. So, transmission line, properly used, low enough in loss, the length absolutely doesn't matter. There's one other catch, though. Every real antenna you and I use, Richie, has got some kind of real impedance. If this is the best of all worlds, the antenna would be 50 ohms from DC to light. Well, the antennas you and I can afford and lay our hands on don't do that. It might be a 70 ohm antenna at 3.8 megs. It might be a 150 ohm antenna at 3.5 megs. The impedance changes pretty fast in some cases. Now the length of the transmission line determines what kind of an impedance you get in the shack. So the length, in that respect, counts a little bit. In other words, if your antenna had a 150 ohm impedance, in my example, at 3.5 megs, that is a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. If your feed line gets longer and longer, and it's lossless, it doesn't change the 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. You still have a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. You still have a certain percentage of the power you send up to the antenna is reflected back. And the reflected...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The reflected amount doesn't change just because you change the length of the line. However, as you make the line longer and longer, the reflected power comes back later and later. That's a shift in phase. So the dot on the Smith chart, which really is a polar plot of phase as a circle around and the length of the arrow from the center is the magnitude of the reflected power. That's what the Smith chart really is. It's a polar plot. As you make the feed line longer and longer, that dot is walking around the perimeter of that Smith chart. So the exact impedance changes, in other words, how much resistance and how much reactance, but the magnitude of the standing wave ratio does not change. So if you ask me, does the length of the feed line matter? Well, from one point of view, no. From another point of view, yes. I've given you both answers. Hopefully it makes a little more sense now, Richie. KC2, LTY, K2RIW, if you want some more info.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. You know, I mean, I have a section of coax approximately 75 feet reduced to, that's the heavy cable, to a thinner coax, which is about 35 feet. And I don't believe that there's any problems. If it's 100 feet or 200 feet or anywhere in between, I don't think there's going to be any difference. As long as it's the proper coax, shielded, properly connected, it doesn't make a difference, in my opinion. Right? Casey 12-2-8.
Jerry Joyce. Eric recognized. I agree with you, Richie. You get on 20 meters, though, and you tell those guys that you've got a certain section of your transmission line is the heavy stuff, and then you suddenly made a transition to the lighter stuff for the last section, or you're going to get all kinds of guys telling you, you can't do that. You can't put a connector in the middle. You can't change the diameter. It's going to explode. You're going to get all kinds of guys telling you that. Pure hogwash. There's lots and lots of theories on this one, and many of them are wrong. I know earlier we said if Eric checks in, we're going to ask him, I know there's some kind of a question we wanted to ask him, but maybe he heard the question, maybe he's going to answer it for us. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. No, I didn't hear the question, but I just did want to point out to you that most of the radios with built-in tuners really can only resolve some of them are 3-to-1, and some of the better ones are 5-to-1. So don't think of them as like an MMSDA tuner with an infinite number of taps on a coil, infinite number of capacitors to put in the circuit. And the other thing was the G5RV, how the feed line comes down the center is a really important part of the antenna, especially at 80 meters. So whether you have that laying against something, or you have it horizontal or vertical, affects the bandwidth of the antenna. I just wanted to point that out. What's the question, Dick?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, Dick. I wanted to finish.
Yeah, the G5RV does have some funny sensitivities. And Eric, before you go away, you remember that I did remember the question, and I'll give it after Mel speaks. Go ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
That was the magic word when I said he's using it. He said a G5RV antenna. The G5RV antenna has that tendency because remember that it is fed the G5RV with 450 ohm ladder line. And so if the dipole on G5RV is usually in the neighborhood of about 62 feet. And if you really, really want to use it across 80 meters, the best thing to do is to get a tuner with a 450 ohm type of balanced input and use it that way. Otherwise, you can't have problems with moving to the edge of the bands on 80 meters with a G5RV takeover.
What's your best guess as to how high the VISWR might be on a G5RV at the end of the band, Mel? Go ahead.
Typically better than 2.5, usually 3-to-1. That's what has been typical, and a number of people have said the same thing. That's why I said when he said that he's using a G5RV, I said, that rings the bell, because that's a typical complaint on the G5RV. So before attempting really to use an external, buying an external tuner, an alternative would be to try different antenna designs, broadbanded designs such as a cage guide pole or whatever you want to go to, but also to suggestion of feeding the dipole with 450 ohm ladder line directly into a balanced input thing.
And so if it gets to numbers like 3-to-1, standing wave ratio at the edges of the band on 80 meters, and where Eric is telling us that some of the automatic antenna tuners built into the rigs that's getting very close to the threshold where they can't go any higher and still give a good match. That would kind of kind of go together. The question that was asked earlier, Eric, is that when Joe, the H-U-R-Y-Y, is using his spectrum analyzer connected to his roof-mounted rotatable antenna that he uses for digital television DXing, and we get a band opening like we have recently, on the lower RF VHF frequencies, channels 2 through 5, roughly 54 to 88 megacycles, he will see during a band opening analog signals, analog television signals, which he believes, in other words, he'll see a carrier at 55.25, for instance, which is the old channel 2 carrier frequency for the video, and 4.5 megs above that, he'll see the audio and so on. So my question to you as a broadcaster engineer is that throughout the United States, when you get a good band opening to the nearest 1,000, 1,500 miles, what's your guess as to how many low-power analog TV stations are still on the air? And is there a guess as to how much longer the license will last? Are we going to have low-power analog TV stations 5 years from now, out of curiosity? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I don't remember the exact date. They think it's around 9 months from now. There's about still, I think there's like 700 or 900 translators and low power TV stations that are still analog. There's actually an analog channel too in New Jersey somewhere. So you'll continue to see that until the end of the term, when they all have to either go digital or go away. K2RW, K2J.
So there's lots of them, 700 of them, low-power TV analogs, and your best guess is maybe their license will expire in approximately 9 months. Does that mean something like February of 2012, they're going...
K4NBC.
Okay. And Bob maybe knows something about this. Bob's in the broadcast industry. I'm going to turn it to Eric first, and then we're going to turn it over to Bob. Eric first, KE2EJ. You think February 2010 is a guess? Over to you, Eric.
No, I don't remember the exact date. I can look it up. I think it's somewhere like April of next year. It's sort of like the major channel to change over to digital. You know, there was a mandated date. It started out earlier, but they extended it to June. But I don't think they're going to do the same thing with the low power folks. But they've had a lot of time. A lot of them have actually changed over. I know VVH down in Southampton, actually there in Waynescott. I think they're going to make a change, a switch in about a month or so. K2RIW, K2J.
So out in Waynescott, there's a low-power TV station. I didn't know about that. Interesting. And finally, I am getting those other channel 11-3 and 11-4. Find out how to do it with my tuner. Bob, I think you work in the broadcast industry, K4, November, Bravo, Charlie. What do you know about low-power TV stations, if that's what you'd like to talk about, and when are they, is their license going to expire? K4NBC to take it, probably by way of IRLP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, good evening, Dick, and everybody else from K4NBC. You know what, I really don't know much about when these licenses expire. I built two low-power stations. One of them turned into a CW network station. And then CBS bought them from the owner. In fact, I built one of the stations twice, the second time when we moved over into the big TV tower. And then CBS bought them and then informed me that I was not competent to be in their employ as a maintenance engineer, and I wasn't qualified to work on the transmitters, the stations that I built. So that's another story. But anyway, we still have an analog 43 and 48 on the air right here in my county, And NBC in Miami is still transmitting on channel 58 analog with 50 kilowatts. I don't know how long this stuff's going to be around. But what I wanted to say was, you know, if you're tuning around on your television set and you still have your old low band, high band UHF TV antenna, and you see sync bars and stuff coming in there, or you pick it up above the 6 meter band, it's most likely Canadian high power low band analog stations coming in. They've got them in Nova Scotia and up there in Ontario. Up in New York, you guys might get the stuff coming in from Western Canada.
Of HROYY. I was getting the stations from a bearing of 250 to 260 degrees approximately.
Which implies to the west. There's a slim chance that Bob timed out his particular link. And Bob, your audio sounded really good. I wonder, are you coming in by IRLP or Echo Link? And let's see if he did time out and come back.
I'm coming in via Echo Link.
Okay, yeah, he sounded good. Let's see if Bob has come back. And how in the world is there an analog signal 50 kilowatts in Miami? Give me a couple of words on that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, that's an interesting one. The only thing I can guess is Cuba. They do a lot of strange things down there, including you can't have a QHF repeater greater than 50 watts.
You can't have a what repeater greater than 50 watts? Is that UHF or VHF? What are you saying on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
You know how at the Northern Florida we have that power that you don't run more than 50
watts on 420.
We have that same power that
we
can down there in Florida.
Patrick Air Force Base.
Okay, so because of Patrick Air Force Base, Bob is telling us you can't run more than 50 watts. And that implies they've got something like a paved pores transmitter. Those paved pores transmitters, there's one at Otis Air Force Base near Rhode Island. And the people within a certain number of miles of that one are not allowed to run more than 50 watts on the 450 band. So I guess that's what's going on. But Bob, K4NBC, what's your best guess as to how a station in Miami is still on analog at 50 kilowatts? How in the world did they get permission to do that? And is their license going to expire at the same time as all the other analog low-power TV stations? K4NBC, K2RIW.
You got me on that one, Dick. I don't know. I'd have to do a FCC TV query search. Those are the correct words. And then I'd have to look it up under WTVJ. Probably because their license was issued, during a... fairly close to the 2009 shutdown date, but they're still up and running, and they're the only show on the air in Miami on analog TV, and I'm sure very few people are now being served by that, but they stayed on, and WTCN and WWHV television, 1 kilowatt at 780 feet, are still on the air analog here in Martin County. So they cover three counties. So, and I don't know when those licenses expire because I wasn't there when they were renewed, but... the cost of ATSC equipment is coming down, and everybody is going to be transmitting over to high def anyway. The low power people want to do it, so and the ones that will be forced to will be basically choked off the air because a lot of these low powers are fledgling and up. Back to you, Dick. I'm sorry.
Very fine, Bob. WTVJ, I think it is, Miami, 50 kilowatts, analog television. What RF channel are they on, Bob, if you happen to know?
Uh, 32. too. You know, they ID as NBC6, but they're really on UHF 32.
Interesting. So when it comes to the low VHF, 54 to 88 megacycles, I guess Bob is saying that quite possibly what Joe was seeing was Canada, but Joe said the signal would peak up to his west, which doesn't fit Canada. So there must be some other low-power TV signal, analog signal, coming from places like Pennsylvania.
They're all over the place. There's even one in New York City.
Oh-ho. So once I set up my my digital television DXing system with the rotator on the top of my tower, Sam, I'm going to be seeing low-power signals from all over the place until February before they disappear. Over to you for any comments on this one, Eric. KE2HA, K2LIW.
I'm doing a not very smart thing. I'm trying to find the actual date while I'm driving. Not a cool thing to do, but since we're not moving, so what the heck. You'll find that a lot of the analog low powers are still operating, so, you know, you got another 9-10 months or a year or whatever it is. I think it's April, but we'll find out. And, yeah, there's still analog DX thing out there. All you gotta do is look.
So Joe still got stuff to look for. And I think we can say, Eric, that the RF channels 2 through 6, 54 to 88 megacycles, when digital television is fully implemented, those channels will be television-wise thoroughly unused. Is that approximately true to your knowledge, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW?
No, here's the thing. There have been some stations that were VHF, low VHF, and they just absolutely had to move to UHF, and the FCC just did some changes. And there are some parts of the country where there are low VHF, where there's a channel 2, and they swear by it. They don't want to change at all. So there's no mandate for them to move off those frequencies at this point, because the information technology bandwidth shortage that they claim to have, they don't seem to want frequencies down there because of the problem. K2RAW, K2J.
By way of the Squignoli material and my own experience, I'm led to believe that the lower VHF band, 54 to 88 megs, is much more vulnerable to impulse noise from power lines and things like that. My impression is that digital television is very vulnerable to impulse noise. Therefore, low-power digital television, or just plain digital television at all, on channels 2 through 6 VHF, real RF channel, I think suffer a disadvantage. That's my impression. I wonder if your experience tends to confirm that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
No, that's one of the big reasons why digital TV don't work too well. It really doesn't work well. You know, I've been with a number of people going into people's houses trying to pick up digital television. Apartments in New York City, it's like, forget it, it's a nightmare. Yes, the receivers are getting better, but it's still a nightmare. That's why they've done a lot of experimenting with distributed television broadcasting. Multiple transmitters on the same frequency. Set up like cell sites here, so to speak, all running synchronous with each other. And you know what? That don't work too well either. K2IWK2J.
So digital television over-the-air broadcast is having a lot of trouble from what you're saying, Eric. And in those apartments in New York City where it's not working, here is going to be a speculation on your part, and I'm asking for, do you you believe it's not working because of signal strength being too low, multipath being too numerous, or impulse noise being too high in specific impulse noise magnitude. So impulse noise, multipath, or signal strength. What do you believe is the major ingredient for the grief in those New York City apartments? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, let's try all of the above. You gotta consider multipath as a real killer. I mean, I'll give you an example. Not so much multipath directly, but indirectly. This was, when was this? This was in the early 90s, okay, when, mid-90s, when ACSD was being demonstrated. When the Coliseum was still the Coliseum, that's how dated this was. There was a Harris DTV truck that came around to show the engineers in different parts of the country what digital television would look like. I'm going to drop. And at that time, CBS had their transmitter at all places, the Empire State Building. That's another long story, how they managed to have that. Because when they moved to the World Trade Center, it seemed that somebody had signed a 99-year lease with the Empire State Building. But that's another day for that story. So they had a digital transmitter up there. They were one of the first ones to put one on the air. Well, up at the Coliseum, they couldn't get, and this is before the good equalizers came around, they couldn't get a signal that would stay locked. So what they did was they turned the antenna the other way and took the reflection off the face of the what was then the Gulf and Western building. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Well, I'm getting the impression that as the digital television ATSC converters develop, their tolerance to multipath is improving. Will they ever get to the day, almost like a rake receiver, where any reasonable amount of multipath in magnitude and number of multipaths, the system can model itself and get rid of the grief? Or have we almost come to the end of the line of that development? What do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, well, have we come to the end of the line in development of transistors and IC? I think not. Actually, mathematically, there have been models that have been created that actually can pretty much tolerate a whole lot of stuff. I don't think we're there yet. I think we got a way to go. It's going to get better. It is getting better. It has gotten better. But it ain't like analog.
But you say it's getting better. It would be getting better at a very nice rate if there was really a driving force. If 95% of the population was watching over-the-air digital television, there would be a real market. In my town of Dix Hills in Huntington, Long Island, I may be the only human being getting over-the-air digital television. In Merrill's town of Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, he may be one of the very few human beings getting over-the-air digital television. So, with such an extremely small percentage in certain communities watching over-the-air, and everybody else is doing cable TV and satellite and all other kinds of medium, fiber, cable, and satellite, I'm getting the impression that the total percentage of people over-the-air is small. Therefore, if you and I were running a company building a digital television converter, and we want to go to the next generation, and we have to invest a whole lot of money, but very few people are going to buy it, wouldn't the chain of command in our company give us some flack on whether or not we're misusing the resources? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Comment.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, and what was it, TV broadcasting, and a couple of weeks back, I don't remember exactly what the number was, but they were celebrating either the 20 millionth or the 25 millionth converter sold. But here's the interesting part. You're not looking at it from
a sociological point of view, you're looking at it purely from a technical point of view, that if you go and you, it's really a socioeconomic point of view, sorry, if you go out into the burbs like you are, where, you know, you pay up to $10,000 a year in taxes, you know, $1,000 for TV services isn't going to bother you all that much. But when you go into the major areas and the depressed areas, you all of a sudden discover that, wait, cable? What's that? You can't afford to do that. Although, yeah, you'll find poor people on welfare and stuff like that with their cell phones and the big TVs, but they don't seem to be the majority of them. And one of the things that we had discovered when the World Trade Center went down, being working for public television, that a huge percentage of the audience started calling the station because they couldn't get their TV, their babysitter to work anymore. K2RIW, K2J. And that, by the way, that number is something like somewhere between 30 and 40% of the viewers.
Comment.
Yeah, comment recognized, but let me ask another question of Eric. If 25 million converters for digital television are out there, does that mean standalone digital converter running into a analog set, or is that digital converters including the ones that are in the modern day set, which has a digital converter built in? The 25 million, what does that represent in the U.S., Eric? Go ahead.
That was standalone converter boxes, not including sets which have tuners built into them. And by the way, as far as the FCC is concerned, the way it seems, they would be happy if broadcasting just went away. Because what or at least the guy in charge is attempting to do is to say, okay, CBS, NBC, and Fox, you don't need to take up 18 megahertz worth of bandwidth. We can fit you all into 1.6 megahertz slot. That gives us a lot more room to play.
Now, that sure would be putting a lot of eggs in one basket. So 25 million stand-alone converters. Alrighty. And a lot of people have bought brand new sets now that digital television is here. Is that another 25 million sets that have been sold with built-in converters? What's your guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, the reality is I actually do not know, but that's another one of those little interesting things I'll find out and just put in the back of my head. That actually is an interesting thought, but, you know, since the beginning of digital television, which was, what, 99? It has grown by leaps and bounds. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the cable companies and the satellite companies are complaining they're losing subscribers because more and more people are discovering that they get multiple sources when they're near a major city in terms of what's available on the over-the-air TV. K2RIWK, do it again.
All right, I'm about to pick up the comment person. One other thing I'm going to pass on to you guys is that if you go to Wikipedia and cell phone as a search word, there are 305 million cell phones in use in the United States right now. 320 is our population. 305 million is the number of cell phones. There are a number of countries like Germany where the number of cell phones is 20 or 30% higher than the total population, men, women, and children. More cell phones than there are people. 5 billion cell phones are in use worldwide right now. 5 billion and 305 million in the United States. My goodness, that's a lot of electronics. Our comment person, give us your full call and your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, this is N2RDB, Tim in West Hempstead. I am, at this moment, I have over-the-air TV on and functioning here in my home. I just got sick and tired of Cablevision after so many years, with the shenanigans with switching the channels around, with the shenanigans of making you get a box for every TV in the house, and, you know, just the corporate strong-arm tactics. I just kind of got sick and tired of the whole thing. Verizon didn't offer much better, and, you know, I realized I'm forking over a nice chunk of money every month for the privilege of having channels that show the same movies over and over and over again, 60 million times. And I just got to a point one day where I said, enough. I'm not paying for this anymore. I refuse.